to re-indigenize, I mean, really means to take back us, take back our culture, to take back the world and the way it should be, to steward the land the way it should be. It's legislation, it's mascots, it's, you know, changing racist colonial holidays, it's getting out the vote. It's basically like taking back our own image and also putting us in spaces that we normally are left out of.
Hello and welcome. As always, I'm Abby. This is Stories Lived, Stories Told. And today, I invite you to join me in conversation with Sakawa Snobis as we take a communication perspective on decolonizing, re-indigenizing, and rematriating. To take a communication perspective is to consider what it is we're making and how we are making it using our communication practices. This means that we look closely at patterns, contexts, stories, and relationships, and that we use curiosity, mindfulness, collaboration, and dialogue to create better social worlds. Whether the content of today's conversation is familiar to you or not, the hope is that using a communication perspective will reveal new ways of seeing and being for all of us. At the top of the episode, you heard our conversation partner today, Sakawa Snobis. Sakawa is Nehiya Salto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada, and grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And now she's located in Iowa. She is the founder and executive director of the Great Plains Action Society. She's an organizer, a speaker, writer, and artist, as well as a mother of two children. As you will hear in our conversation today, Sakawa believes that land defense and social justice work are inextricably linked, and that change will only happen when we dismantle corrupt colonial capitalist systems and rebuild them with a decolonized worldview. This conversation is an important addition to our sustainability series because we really do need to take an intersectional lens. So we can't talk about climate action, sustainable practices, or environmental justice without talking about a host of other issues, and particularly the systems that we live under that create the conditions for these issues. This conversation today is a little bit of a 101, an information download, if you will. Sakawa shares about her work with Great Plains Action Society and helps us understand some important language like the words you see in the title of this episode. Indigenous perspectives are still missing in a lot of spaces, so this might be your first introduction to some of the ideas Sakawa talks about. And she doesn't speak for all Indigenous people, of course, but her perspective, her experiences, and her stories are really valuable. I'm really excited to share this conversation with you and for all of us to learn something new together and to consider new ways of being in the world. So let's begin the conversation with Sakawa. Hi, Sakawa. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation today. I've really been looking forward to speaking with you.
Hello, Tansi, Mio, Ponapitigisigao. Hello, good afternoon. I've also been looking forward to it as well.
Awesome. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself and just share enough about yourself so we can have some context going into this conversation and have a better idea of who you are?
My name is Sakawa Snobis, which we've already established. It's hard to start off introducing yourself without saying your name.
Right.
And I'm Plains Cree Salto of the George Gordon First Nation, also Nehiya, which is another more correct term for Plains Cree. And I grew up in Winnipeg, which is not too far from there, a few hours to the west. And that's a very, what I call like the riziest city on Turtle Island, just because there's at least about 100,000 Native folks living there. So when people say I didn't grow up in a Native community, well, I sure did. Mm-hmm. And let me see. And then I've been living in Iowa City for 19 years now. I came here for school, for graduate school. I had a presidential fellowship to get my PhD, but I got my master's instead because I realized that I didn't have the right resources here as I was going through all that. And so I have a master's degree in religious studies and a graduate minor in Native American studies. And I stayed here because I had my children here and my co-parent liked it here. And so we ended up just thinking we were going home every year, but eventually I became a citizen, and now I have a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I am the founder and executive director of Great Plains Action Society. Great Plains Action Society is about 7 years old.
Okay, very cool. Well, that's a great place to start. And I'm curious, now that we know a little more about your background, to dig into the background of the Great Plains Action Society. So what was the story around you founding the Great Plains Action Society?
The story actually stems out of loneliness. As an Indigenous person here in Iowa, I was just so, I guess, kind of in culture shock, because I was just so used to being around lots of Natives and working with Natives. As I started my, I guess, career as an organizer when I was 19. And in Canada, it's just, it's very different. And so there's a lot more representation, and there's just a lot more that's going on kind of everywhere, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of Natives and us just not being like stuck in history like they are here, whitewashed and erased like they are to a big extent here in the U.S. Not that that isn't happening in Canada.
Sure.
But that, like, it just was kind of a culture shock here to see the much less representation. And so after I graduated, while I was at the university, I was the president of the Native American Student Association, and I was on all sorts of diversity committees, some environmental committees. I don't even remember now. That was so long ago, and there was so many of them. I think I might have even got some awards. But I seriously don't remember. And I did some fun stuff for NASA. I did not like do the powwow that is typically done every year, because that was a time when we weren't getting funding for that. I did some other stuff. I did like a Native American Arts Month, where I did like a modern take on our art, like, you know, what people are doing in all sorts of different forms, like even cooking. Mm. You know, before the sous chef was, I guess, popular, I brought a chef here from Canada called Chef Wolfman. And he came and did a cooking demonstration. Plus, we had a big banquet as we watched, and, you know, had a youth art show, and people come in to read different pieces of work and some other stuff. So, you know, that was a while ago. I mean, that was 19 years ago. And, you know, then I graduated, and I just felt like, wow, like, now what, you know, like, they started the powwow up soon after I graduated. And so I helped out with that for a couple of years, but it just felt really lonely, you know, because, you know, in Iowa, this place was very, very genocided, very, the Natives were also very much pushed out for the sake of this farmland here. Between 1830 and 1860, this place was like, you know, there was a serious attack on this land. And, you know, even to the point where the king at the time, you know, put an order out, you know, to make sure that all Meskwaki folks were exterminated, if you will, genocided. And so, you know, the Iowa, who are the, I guess you could say, the rightful descendants of this land, it's just hard, because there's a lot of people that have come through Iowa. You know, a lot of different tribes, like, that have come through, that have been here temporarily, you know, or that traveled among here, right? Like, I would say, like, a big chunk of it was Iowa land. And then they were pushed out, and the Meskwaki came in 200 years ago. And so, you know, I just really want to, you know, uplift that right now, because that's important, you know, in terms of my land acknowledgement. That's these folks, these wonderful tribes were gone. And except for the Meskwaki, who came back, and but they're quite small, and they have a small settlement in the middle of the state. And in a good way, they're insular, because I don't blame them, because why wouldn't you be, right? You know, they do their thing and they're doing wonderful things there. But, you know, there are those of us that don't live there, right? Like, there's 16,000 Natives, and I think there's 1,500 Meskwaki that live on the settlement, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people like living outside of the settlement.
Yeah. Is that 16,000 Natives in Iowa?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there's, you know, and the bigger population in Sioux City. I don't even know what the population, I need to get the numbers there, because it's probably our largest population of Natives in the state, for sure. And then, of course, there's little chunks of the Ho-Chunk Reservation and the Omaha Reservation that come into mm-hmm. Iowa as well, over the Missouri River. But so, like I said, like, it it does feel like really lonely in terms of, you know, being an Indigenous person here, and especially in Iowa City. And so I just said, well, we need something. Like, we need some kind of social organization, right? Like something. And, you know, I had started organizing when I was 19 at the New Brunswick Aboriginal People's Council. And so I had some experience with, you know, community organizing and understood, like, you know, how that works. And as I went through university and all that, like, I understood that much better. Mm-hmm. And I tried asking, you know, folks that would come through town to get together and try to do stuff. You know, it wasn't anything in particular at the time. It was just like, let's just get together, you know. Yeah. And nothing ever really came out of it. Like, it was really nice to have folks at my house and hang out, but I was a very transient place. And so folks come and go a lot. They come for school or the writer's workshop or whatever, and then they're gone. And so I don't know, I didn't have a lot of luck. But then I went to Standing Rock because, of course, like, I just felt like the need to go, just like a lot of folks did. Like, it was a really huge pull in my heart to be there. And once I went there and came back and started talking about, like, you know, what I was doing, you know, just on social media, a lot of folks here, like Native folks, were like, took quite an interest in it and asked me to, you know, come and speak about it and tell us about my time there. And then, you know, they started helping me put together stuff to bring up there, like donations, mm-hmm. clothing and food, things like that. And, you know, I don't know, like, because I, you know, through that, that's how Great Plains Action Society got founded, actually, because people took a real interest and Indigenous people kind of, they stuck around and we ended up doing more and more things together. And I would say Trisha Rivers is like the first person that came on board that really started like working as a staff member at GPOS and helped found it. She's definitely a founder, you know, helped get it off the ground. From there on, we just kept growing. So now we have two full-time people. That would be me and Trish, and I think 5 part-time folks. And one of those people is Tobias, who is a youth organizer. So we have youth that have been on with us. We had 2 other youth, Keely and Alex, that both graduated from university, and so now they're off doing their thing. Keely's at grad school, and Alex is teaching at Little Priest Tribal College. And I think actually Alex is going to grad school now too, coming up this fall. And so, not that we're responsible for their success at all, yeah. But I like to think that a tiny part of what we did helped empower them, you know, and yeah. just be more of like the badasses that they are today.
Yeah. So,
and yeah, so we are a 501c3 organization, and we are 100% Indigenous led and run, and we work across Iowa and Eastern Nebraska and Southern South Dakota, and actually in Minneapolis now, and or Minnesota, I guess you could say. And we are doing stuff often as well, like through cohorts and events, like kind of throughout the Midwest, or I like to call it the Great Plains, and then even nationally.
Yeah, well, that's very cool. And yeah, insightful to be able to hear the story and hear that it, yeah, really rooted in this idea of community, and that I'm sure you're not the only person that was experiencing loneliness. Obviously, you know, very evident, and there's a need for this kind of collection. And I'm curious, you know, obviously the name Great Plains Action Society, I want to know a little more about the action. Like, what kind of events, what kind of actions do you do at the Great Plains Action Society?
Yeah. So, well, firstly, before we move into the word action, I just want to define the term society for you, because that's actually pretty important too.
Yeah.
A society is traditionally in some Indigenous cultures. I know that Lakota folks have that, and Cree folks have them. And also, I'm sure other folks do. I just don't want to apply it, because I mean, we have such a diverse range of tribes and cultures. But I'm pretty sure it would be something that would be kind of common, right? Like, because it seems like it's common it's a commonality you might find throughout most civilizations and communities throughout the world. So a society is like a small working group. They work together on daily tasks or on, you know, issues that come up, and, you know, they are closely knit. And when it's their time to do whatever it is they do it. And that's why I wanted to call us a society, as well as Trish, because Trish and I brainstormed on that name, because that's how it feels. Like we're not really a membership based organization.
Right.
That would be very hard in a state like Iowa, even though there are lots and lots of natives. Finding them and getting their attention to join this organization would be hard. And we do have a lot of support from white folks who are wonderful in supporting us. But I would guess that the majority of our membership would probably be like white folks. And so that would be really weird. Because, sure. You know what I mean? We're not here to serve white folks.
Right.
Like, we're here to serve Indigenous peoples and the land. And not that we don't like love the white folks that support us and that are our allies and accomplices, but that they have to take kind of a back seat in the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
Because it's really about overcoming racism, you know, systematic white supremacy, and so many other issues that come along with, you know, with white folks. You know, like, not that all white folks are the problem, but white supremacy is, right?
Yes.
So that's what I'm trying to get at. So yeah, that's why we call ourselves a society. And then, yeah, of course, we wanted to use the word action, because we see out there that, and this is not just like white organizations, this is other organizations as well, that there's a lot of, I guess you could say, online activism, which is in and of itself is also not a bad thing, since so many people kind of live online now, right? But that, like, we don't feel that, like, you know, a graphics campaign is going to change the world, right?
Right, right.
Also that, like, a lot of organizations get paid, or not get paid, but they raise a lot of money to do, again, you know, just online stuff, or not really doing what they say they're going to do. And so we just really want to try hard to be the opposite of that, and try our best to use the funding that we get to make as big of an impact as possible. And so, you know, again, coming back to Trish, she's done amazing work building our Protect the Sacred program in Sioux City, where we the main focus is ending the missing and murdered Indigenous relatives crisis, which means a whole lot of stuff, right? It means empowering people. It means healing people, community, giving people opportunities that they normally wouldn't have. Because there we have high rates of poverty and very high rates of houselessness. Indigenous peoples there make up about 2-3% of the population, maybe a little more, like sometimes, just because there's a lot of going back and forth between the reservations, which are really close to Sioux City, you know, Omaha and Winnebago reservations and Sioux City. So they make up this percentage, probably about 2-3%, but yet we make up, you know, 45-63% of the houseless population. So it's pretty bad. So, you know, Trisha founded this, you know, amazing program there, or initiative, I should say, and has been growing it ever since she moved back there in 2018. And I mean, there's just so much going on. There's a women's and girls Protect the Sacred workshop that happens every Sunday or every Sunday, I believe. There's Indigenous Peoples Day celebrations every year on May 5th, I guess you could say a gathering to honor the missing and murdered Indigenous Woman Day of Awareness. The National Day of Awareness. And so there's protests, you know, like when reproductive freedom was on the chopping block, which of course it still is.
Yeah.
You know, we've had protests there. And then after the Supreme Court did not overturn ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, you know, we had a celebration. We have a lot of mutual aid events They just gave out, hundreds of pounds of buffalo from our buffalo harvest that myself and Shelley Buffalo spearheaded down in Missouri. And so, geez, I'm trying to think of all the things that go on there.
so much. Many. Yeah.
Yeah. There's much more, and I'm not even getting. Yeah.
No, that's a great start. And I'll definitely provide people a link to the website so they can explore all of the things that you do for themselves too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then there's the powwow. We just started doing a powwow a couple of years ago, missing and murdered Indigenous relatives powwow. That's a really big deal because that is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And we need to raise a lot of money for that one. And so that's just one initiative, though. We have three initiatives, right? So that's our Protect the Sacred initiative. We have our Land Defense initiative, and we have our Representation initiative. Our Land Defense initiative is the heart of everything that we do. It's how we were founded, right? Because we were founded on fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. And, you know, we started a resistance camp here in Iowa called Little Creek Camp. We helped over at Mississippi Stand Camp, which was on the Mississippi River, you know, in Iowa. And I did a lot of like work going back and forth between Standing Rock and Iowa, just trying to educate people and get people involved, but working together between Standing Rock and Iowa. And I think I did a good job at that, you know, just trying to educate people and make it not just a fight that natives were fighting at Standing Rock, because actually the fight against the pipeline started in Iowa in 2014. So it started before the Standing Rock fight happened, but it's the same pipeline, right? So people in Iowa were fighting it already as of 2014, and then 2016 came around, and then they started to fight the pipeline at Standing Rock. And then it got like huge news and like, you know, thousands of people. And I guess what I was trying to do is to get people to understand that it's a pipeline. Right. Sorry. I'm being kind of like a little bit of a little mean right now, maybe, because I'm just like it doesn't just exist there, right? Like it's transporting fossil fuel, you know, and it went through North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, I think a little tiny touch up in Nebraska, and then Iowa. And I don't even know if it went through Nebraska, and then Iowa, and then Illinois, right, to a refinery where then it was like refined and then sent down to, I believe, Texas. But yeah, I was just like, I found it funny because I'd be like, this is a pipeline. It goes somewhere. It's long, you know, it's a multi-state project. You know, maybe we should be looking at this from a larger picture. Whereas I felt like, you know, the picture at Standing Rock was very much honed in on that area, but for good reason as well, because there was people that were fighting for Indigenous sovereignty on unceded treaty territory. There was that whole aspect of it as well. So yeah, we were really founded because of that fight and what we did here in Iowa, and then also because of how we've since the beginning as well been also fighting big ag or agribusiness or like the big agricultural industry, if you want to call it that, you know, because here it's just so bad. I would call like Iowa a sacrifice zone for big ag, big ag's bitch, if you will. And I don't know if I can swear on your podcast.
You're allowed. But, you're allowed.
Okay. And it has completely destroyed the ecosystem here, the water, the air, the land, and the cancer rates here are climbing. I think they're the second highest, and you should double check this fact, but the second highest rising cancer rates are here in Iowa right now.
Wow.
And this is all due to what the industry of big ag has brought with it, you know, monocropping, which has led to loss of soil, massive loss of soil, massive. Yeah. So, you know, in some cases we might have only 60 harvests left, you know, where there used to be in some cases like 9 feet of topsoil, you know, we're now down to inches. Right.
Yeah.
And so the landscape is completely changed. Like 90% of it is being like has been transformed, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the most biologically altered
Yeah.
Place in the country. I call it the most biologically colonized state in the country. One of the number one contributors to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, like at least from up here, right? At least from these northern states.
Yeah.
Like I was given out the most.
Yeah.
It's the most pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, fertilizers, pig waste, animal waste in general. But it's all going into the water. And I don't know why people swim here. It honestly scares me to think that people swim. My children do not swim in these waters.
Yeah.
They went to a camp, Taproot Camp, which I do like love because it's an outdoor excursion kind of camp and they go all over doing stuff, right? But then like, you know, they let them go swimming in the waters around here sometimes. And I just like, I freak out.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, the one rule I have for my kids at this camp is I don't want them in the water. As much as that sucks, right? Because
yeah.
It's summertime and your kids should be swimming in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'll take them to a pool.
Yeah.
I do not want them in these waters. It's disgusting. It's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, people come out with like flesh-eating bacteria because there's such a growth of bacteria as well, right?
Uh-huh.
Because they love to eat off, you know, all those things like the nitrates and whatever. Mm. And then there's just all these chemicals, these really, really, really disturbing chemicals. And so we have been fighting Big Ag for a while, you know, and then, of course, coal. There's coal plants here that are harming, you know, indigenous communities like the Sioux City community and the reservations, Omaha and Winnebago reservations, because Mid-American has two coal plants, like the oldest and dirtiest in the nation, that are situated like right above Winnebago and right below Sioux City. And so that's happening there. And then now for the past like 2.5 years, oh geez, maybe it might even be coming up on 3 years. I'm not even sure. We've been fighting CO2 pipelines. So these are pipelines. This is a whole new thing.
Yeah.
They want to bring in these pipelines that are going to cap off at like ethanol plants. Oh, yeah, I didn't even mention ethanol, did I?
Not yet. Yeah.
Another dangerous practice that goes on here in Iowa. You know, the growing of corn for the sake of making, you know, fossil fuels or blending it with fossil fuels to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And your, you know, listeners can't hear that, but I did quotations.
Right. Air quotes.
Yeah. I did the cheesy air quotes because it's not better. It's causing disaster, environmental disaster here in Iowa.
Yeah. That's the time to ask, better for who?
Yeah. Better for the oil industry.
Yeah. Right. Obviously. Yep.
And these CO2 pipelines are where Big Oil and Big Ag are actually kind of shaking hands, because these are have been lobbied for heavily by the oil industries, because in the end, the liquefied CO2 that they're taking out of these CO2 that they're taking out of these places, these like meatpacking factories and these ethanol plants, what have you. And then they convert into CO2, liquefied CO2, they are allowed to use it for enhanced oil recovery, meaning like fracking.
Mm-hmm.
So they use that as the liquid to go down into the ground and bring up oil. It's just a real con.
Yeah.
And it's actually in the end not effective. And it provides industry for the ethanol and fossil fuel industry, which then gives them tax deductions, right? It gives them credits, right? And it's really, they're just going to rip into the land again and build massive amounts of pipelines all over the state, which can, in fact, be dangerous, because it's almost like more dangerous in a way in terms of the short-term effects of a rupture, because if a CO2 pipeline breaks, it doesn't just like leak, right? It kind of explodes, and you end up with like miles of it can be miles depending on how much comes out, right? Or
yeah,
a very large area of this cloud of CO2 like settling down onto the ground, and basically everything in the area asphyxiates because it, you know, displaces oxygen.
Yeah.
So there's that. It's dangerous that way. It's dangerous that, you know, if it gets where they dump it underground in these caverns, saying that it's safe down there, that, you know, like it. How do they know it's like not going to, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do they know it's not going to mix with, like, you know, eventually like an underground aquifer or just who knows? Like, yeah. It's just ridiculous. It's such unproven technology and it's very new, and like nobody knows anything really about the long-term effects, because there aren't long-term effects that we know of yet.
Yeah.
A good source for your listeners to look up is the Huffington Post article on Satartia, Mississippi, and what happened there and how a rupture almost killed an entire town. So that's what we've been fighting, because I was kind of like ground zero for them right now.
Mm-hmm.
Summit Carbon Solutions, which is one of the pipeline companies, is actually like located. Their headquarters are actually here in Ames, Iowa. I was just there the other day giving them the finger. So, and then like Navigator was actually, they actually canceled their pipeline project, but Summit has intentions of taking on what they were going to do. So, so they're still fighting away there.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of different people in the game. There's landowners, which are majority white and conservative, fighting it. You know, of course, there's environmentalists, and then there's us, Indigenous peoples. We're the only Indigenous-led organization that's been on the ground doing it, and we're trying to change that.
Mm-hmm.
That's my goal for the year, to try and get more Native people like doing this work. So yeah, that's just one example of the stuff that we do. And then, of course, there's our representation initiative. So our representation initiative is really based off the fact that like a lot of we face such high rates of erasure. I was talking about that earlier,
mm-hmm.
and romanticization and tokenization and just stereotypes, right? And we're also not included in a lot of spaces that we should be included in. That includes voting, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's high rates of voter suppression in Indian country. And so we have a GOTV campaign, and this year we're going to be focusing on reproductive liberation and, you know, bans on diversity, equity, and inclusion and trans bans and all the stuff happening with kids with disabilities, or like, these are all things that are basically attacked in Iowa, right? Not that we haven't always lived with white supremacy from an Indigenous perspective. I can tell you that this country and Canada, right, they have always done what they can to, you know, keep slowly genociding us, right? To continue the process of colonization, right? Like, that's why even in Canada as well, like, the textbooks don't tell real history.
Right.
My children's textbooks don't tell them the real history of what went on in this country, right? I think there's some, like, really large number out there. And I want to say 40% of people, like, don't even think, and this is in the U.S., I don't even think Indigenous people exist anymore. So, you know, it's like, and that's by design, right?
Yeah.
So we have as part of our representation initiative, like a shirt campaign and hoodie campaign with Humanize My Hoodie, with shirts and hoodies that say the truth will not be whitewashed. That is attached as well to our Truthsgiving event that we have every year. We have this event here in Iowa City called Truthsgiving. Jeez, it started in my house a long time ago when I first moved here, because I don't know why. I think before I moved here, I never really put much thought into Thanksgiving in Canada.
I think that's true for a lot of people.
Yeah, because even though we celebrate Thanksgiving there, I don't feel like people make a big deal about the Pilgrim and Indian thing.
Uh-huh.
As like they do here.
Right. That's the whole, middle of the story.
Like the whole story. Yeah. The whole story. And I don't even know if I knew, like, I mean, I've looked it up since then, and it's just a different kind of story in Canada. And you know, it's just part of our learning process when we're decolonizing ourselves. Right. So I just never really thought about it in Canada, but then I moved here and it's so apparent here, the story, right?
Yes.
It's so like, yes, this whole mythology is built off of Pilgrims and Indians. And, you know, I was just so like, wow, especially 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because back then it was still really okay to like put up all the little decorations with the Pilgrims and the Indians and to dress up like that and to have the plays and the parades and like all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I like to think that part of our work has, I feel kind of proud, because I feel like our work has been part of a much larger process of Indigenous peoples across, you know, the nation pushing back at it, right? So, you know, when we first came here, I was like, well, I want to celebrate this, because I mean, these are all technically indigenous foods, right? Like in a lot of ways, potatoes and turkey. And it's supposed to be, right? Because we're celebrating an original harvest. A lot of cases, people also, you know, use wild rice and there's sweet potatoes and beans. Geez, like that's part of our three sisters, beans, corns, and squash, right? So all that's part of it as well. And I was like, I want to do that. Of course I want to do that. And of course I want to spend time with my family and friends and, you know, gather and enjoy the harvest. And that's the whole idea. And to be thankful for what you have. I mean, that's a great idea, right? But the whole mythology that it's resting upon is bullshit.
Yeah.
It's complete whitewashing of the truth. And again, it's an erasure of us as indigenous peoples and our identities, because it's telling people that we were like happy with what was going on. And we sat down and had this wonderful harvest and shared it with these white folks, which is not the case at all. Almost like they're trying to say that like we wanted people to come here. We were okay with them coming here. No, that's not the case. Within 4 days of some of these pilgrims coming onto our shores, they were raiding the stores of their reserves, right, for the winter and such. And, you know, they brought disease with them. So like the first wave that came onto the shores of the indigenous folks on the East Coast, they were, you know, they were killed by disease.
Yeah.
And then like the second wave that came through was able to, I guess, take advantage of the situation. Let's just put it that way. And so Truthsgiving celebrates the real history of this country. And I started, you know, just saying it in my house, like, we're not just celebrating Thanksgiving, we're celebrating Truthsgiving. Yeah. And I would give a little speech about it, of course. And then my friend Dave Whiting, my good friend, an amazing ally, said to me one day, why don't you like have like a Truthsgiving event, you know, because he plays music. And he's like, we could have it over, you know, at El Bandito's, this old restaurant that used to be here. One of our friends owns it. And I said, okay, great. So we had this little event there. We had people speak, we had people play music. And it kind of became a thing. So now that we're doing it at the Englert Theater, the big fancy theater in downtown Iowa City. And, you know, we have like a band that's been coming now for a couple of years and is going to come again this year, I hope, Audio Pharmacy. And they're like a really amazing indigenous band. They're out in the Bay Area. The lead singer, Roz, is Pomo. And so they're hopefully coming again. And we've had, you know, a few hundred people show up each time.
Yeah.
So it's become kind of a thing now. And then, of course, we, you know, we have fought mascots and we still continue to do it. Right now, we're working on the mascot in Indianola and the name of the school, the Indians or the something like that. Indianola Indians. Yeah. So those are all representation, you know, issues. Mm-hmm. So there's like I said, it's legislation, it's mascots, it's, you know, changing racist and, you know, colonial holidays. It's getting out the vote. It's basically like taking back our own image and also putting us in spaces that we normally are left out of. Mm-hmm. That's our three initiatives. Sorry it took so long to describe all that.
No, it was great. And you know, this may be very heavily just informational podcast, but I think that's a great place to start. I'd love to assume that people listening, you know, are well-versed in these kinds of things. But like you're saying, the history that most people are getting in their schools, which is maybe the only story they've really heard or know, is letting them down. So I think kind of starting with, you know, kind of like even like this vocab lesson, talking about the society and the action. And there's some other words I want to talk about too, that I know you use. I think it's important just to start where we have started, because what I'm hearing and what you're saying is, which I, again, imagine is maybe a new kind of idea for people to play around with and think about, white people to play around with and think about, to see the kind of intersectionality of it all, that you are saying, you know, all we have a hand in kind of all of these areas because they are all connected, because they do have to do with all of us, or they all have to do with us and our experiences. And yeah, there's wisdom to be found. There's good perspective to be found. There's good action to be taken from an indigenous perspective that's missing when the dominant perspective is this white colonial capitalist one that I know you reference a lot. My work in what I call taking a communication perspective, which just references kind of the lens that I use to see the world, thinking about the way things are communicated, and really at the heart of that, thinking about stories. So as I've been preparing for this conversation, one of the biggest kind of things that came out of using my communication perspective when thinking about your work is to think about the stories that have been told. And that's important to do in general. Think about the stories that we've heard, the stories that have been told, also the stories that have gone untold, because those shape us too, their absence. And especially in our conversation, I think one other important thing to pay attention to as you reflect is the voice, you know, who has been able to tell the story. And I see that throughout everything that you just shared, that there really has been one dominant story that's been allowed to persist. And it is this capitalist colonial version.
Yes.
And so, right, there's more justice to be had, maybe more wisdom, better ways of being together in the world when we listen to Indigenous perspectives. So that's something I'd love to keep talking about, this relationship that I'm hearing. You know, the land initiative is the core of what you're doing, what you said. And so I'm curious about the relationship that you see between, you know, environmental justice and social justice, you know, all of these other versions of justice that need to happen.
Yeah. So when people ask me to describe what we do, that takes such a long time. I haven't been able to get to, I guess, kind of the more of the ideological or, you know, philosophical, like, takes on what we do. And, you know, I haven't mentioned the word Christian yet. And that's very important.
Right.
Because actually, I often call, you know, Christian colonial capitalism, because like the three of them are inextricably linked.
Yes.
And we talk about the three aspects of God, right? God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit. Well, I kind of overlay, you know, capitalism, colonialism, and Christianity on top of that.
Right, right.
And that's because, you know, essentially there, you know, the dog, like the, one of the main dogmas to come out of the Bible, right? Like the First Testament, is that God gave man dominion over the earth. And that can be interpreted however you want to interpret it, because lots of modern Christians will try to change that and interpret it a different way. But essentially it is what it is, right? You can't change some of this stuff. Like some of this stuff is pretty evident in what they're saying. And that, you know, women are subservient to men, you know, that's very evident in the Bible. Exceedingly evident, right? And like just that in itself. So these two ways of being in the world, right? Yeah. Where God gives men dominion over the earth, right? And where women are subservient, and Indigenous ways of being. I'm not saying it's like this everywhere, but in general, we can safely say that there is a respect for the earth. There's a respect for the world around you, the land, you know, and there's also, in a lot of cases as well, a lot more respect for women. And so these are just so opposite.
Yeah. And that's where the stories come in for me, because if you've grown up in a Christian colonial capitalist society world, then you kind of take that for granted as the story, you know, capital T story. And yeah, you just take for granted that that is the way things are. And then when you can learn about another perspective, like what you've just shared, that's where, you know, this other part of a communication perspective comes in for me. That's around the meaning making, that none of this meaning is innate. It is not innate that man rule over the land, or women are lesser than men, or that white people are better than everybody else, or dominant. In the way that white supremacy would have you believe is the kind of innate meaning around things. But when we look at these stories, then we can create new meaning. So that's why there's a kind of hope, you know, that is at the core of like the work that you do, I would say, to say that there is the opportunity for change, because we can change the meaning we're making. We can change the meaning around our relationship to land. We can change the meaning that we're making in the stories that we're telling and in our relationships to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, when you asked me just now, like how is climate or environmental justice linked to social justice? You know, for Indigenous peoples, that's very clear, right? Because we never extracted ourselves from nature. Like this whole idea that nature exists out there and humans exist in here doesn't make any sense, right? Yeah. Because we're all like, we're here together.
Yeah.
We're on this earth together with everything else on it, with all the trees, with all the water, with all the animals, right? Like we're a part of the environment, you know, and I tell this to people a lot and I'll say it again. The earth is the only thing that is real, right? Like it's, you can touch it. You can be on it. You can nourish yourself with it. You can live from the earth. The earth provides you with sustenance to live. Everything that we do on it is kind of an illusion. It is an illusion, right? Like this computer that we're talking through right now, right? Like that only exists because somebody thought of it and made it, but it doesn't really need to exist in order for us to exist.
Yeah.
But the earth sure does.
Yes.
Right. Everything we make from the earth is just what we have, you know, envisioned through our minds. And it makes me laugh that like we ended up with like some kind of society where like you need to have insurance and
yes,
you know, you need to like pay bills for whatever and, you know, have credit card interests, right? Like,
yeah,
this is the society that like Christian colonial colonizers built
right.
the world.
Right.
And it's like, and it's killing us.
Mm-hmm.
When colonizers first came here to kill us, essentially, one of the first things they did, of course, was to kill the heart of the family, the woman, to rape them, to enslave them, to kill them. You know, there are horrid stories about like what people did to pregnant women, cutting babies out of them, cutting babies up in front of parents, just throwing them in water, in the water. You know, there's stories I've heard about, you know, where colonial militias and settler vigilantes would bury babies in the ground and kick their heads off. They would compete to see who could kick the head off the furthest, right?
Oh my God.
I know. You want to talk about crimes against humanity. I mean, like, this is it.
Yeah.
Starvation that went on here. What's going on in Palestine right now is a small example of what happened here. I mean, like, just think about that. Oftentimes we talk about, you know, when we talk about genocide in this world, in this country, people talk about what Jewish people went through, right, during the World War II. But the numbers are just, you know, much less as to what happened here. Here was like, you know, like this massive, like killing of like millions and millions and millions of people, right? Mm. Through biowarfare, through starvation, through relocation, through internment camps, both like the reservations and the boarding schools, where children were abused, raped, and murdered and unceremoniously dumped into the ground, right? With no, with nothing, right? No prayer, anything. And this went on for hundreds of years, right? It's still going on. It's still going on.
Mm-hmm.
We still have our children being stolen from us through social welfare systems, even though ICWA exists. We still have the highest rate of missing and murdered people in the country. Why is that? Well, how could you possibly like think that like it wouldn't be happening? Like if it was what this country was built upon, right? This country was built upon the genocide of Indigenous peoples, right? And it's like, and then people were like, well, they stopped doing that. It's like, no, they didn't really just stop doing it. It exists still. And then like also genocide through paper, right? So, you know, just trying to blood quantum us out, if you will. Back to like the land, the first thing that they did was attack, you know, the heart of the family and the family units, because we had a lot of strength there. And then our connection to the land, and then they broke our connection to the land, and that's who we are. You know, we are the land is us, like it goes together. And this is the same for anybody anywhere in the world. If you take them out of their environment and just throw them somewhere without any resources, you're going to kill them, right? look like. Again, if you want to take a modern day perspective on that, you can look at Palestine. But I don't just like to look at Palestine, right? Because like, it's not the only place that's being genocided right now.
Yeah.
There's places all over that are going through that, and they don't get the kind of press that you're getting in Palestine because they're not important to the U.S., right?
Exactly.
Palestine and Israel are important to the U.S. because of, again, Christianity and having a toehold in the promised land, right? And, you know, Sudan isn't important because of that. So Sudan is not important because it's honestly, in my opinion, too, they're Black people, you know, because the darker the skin is, your skin is in this world, the more, I think anyway, I will say that the more racism you're going to face. And it's very much connected. They cannot not be connected. This is like, to me, that's a Christian colonial capitalist concept, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that people ask that question sometimes, and no offense.
And yet, that's okay. I felt like it's necessary because I imagine there's people out there that jump, that connection is not so natural to make. Like you said, it should be, but it is not because of the kind of clouding, the lens that is formed when you exist in a white Christian colonial capitalist society. I wanted to talk, like I mentioned earlier, you know, maybe kind of continuing this vocabulary lesson, again, in the hopes that this maybe can give people a stronger foundation for engaging with, you know, the kind of work that you do or conversations. Just two more words. I'd love to have you kind of define what they mean to you, because I know they're ones that you use and have to do with the kind of action that can result from being able to name these things. Is the rematriation you talk about, and also re-indigenizing. I feel like those are probably words that a lot of people have not heard or are not familiar with. So I'd love to know what they mean to you.
Yeah, to re-indigenize, I mean, really means to take back us, take back our culture, to take back the world and the way it should be, to steward the land the way it should be. I keep telling folks this when I give talks on fighting big ag lately, and that's that white people can't farm. If they knew how to farm, we wouldn't be in this predicament right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you had a farm, we would be living a lot better.
Right. Right. And I'm hearing the subtext of what you're saying is that if they knew how to farm in relationship with the land, right, in the kind of perspective that you're talking about.
I mean, I don't even think that what they're doing is farming, really, right? I mean, I guess it is. I guess it's like the apocalyptic way of farming.
Right, doing it in a dominating the land kind of way rather than a being in relationship with it kind of way.
In relation with the land, yeah. So, you know, to re-indigenize means to like take those things back that were taken from us and to start, you know, doing things the way that they should be done. A lot of people think, well, it's all been lost. It's gone. It's in the past. You know, like that's not true.
Yeah.
We're very tenacious people. We kept a lot of practices and cultures. There's a lot of traditional ecological knowledge out there that needs to come to the forefront and needs to be the way things are done. That's what re-indigenizing means. Rematriation is a term that I use a lot because I prefer that term instead of the term land back. But it also means more than land back. So I'm sure a lot of people that listen to you might know what that term means. It's pretty self-evident, right?
Mm-hmm.
It means give stolen land back to Indigenous peoples so that we can, you know, do what we have to do and do it right. But also it means to bring back the matriarchy. It means to re-feminize the world as well.
Mm.
I wrote an article in Reckon.news, if people want to check it out, if you want to put the link there.
Yeah, I will.
And it says, rematriation describes an entire movement that is not just intent on returning land, but making sure that Indigenous life ways return so we can build a regenerative and compassionate world economy. So while we will not rematriate the world in my lifetime, the term allows a new understanding. I consider this planet to be my mother, and therefore she is a matriarch. I believe that by doing this work, I am following the path of my ancestors. who put me on a path to keep my mother safe. And then I said, to protect all living beings and sacred sites is a feminine act and in complete defiance to the patriarchy.
Yeah.
So to rematriate is, yes, to try to get land back. It's also to bring back the prairie. It's also to bring back the feminine, and the matriarchy, which has been lost. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Christian colonial capitalism is a patriarchy. It is a very toxic patriarchy that is misogynistic as well. Mm-hmm. So not only is it that men are ruling, which can happen in some cases, right? Like in some of our, you know, tribes, that's the case, but also that it's misogynistic.
That's a good distinction to make. Yeah.
Yeah. And that women are treated very badly. They are devalued in a huge way. And it's unfortunate because, and sorry, men out there that listen to this, but I do think that men need direction from women in this world, not because we're better, but because I think that if you have the sacred obligation to bear a child, and that's also for femme folks, right? Femme folks and women. Well, then I think that you should be given great consideration and respect by your community. And mothers are our first caretakers and our first nurturers, right? And so we need to respect that. And men just don't. They do not. So many men have such internalized misogyny and they haven't worked through it yet.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate because we don't even have like programs or, you know, even anything in our schools that help teach boys like how to respect, you know, girls and women. And we need that really badly. Yeah. That's whole part of the decolonization process, right? It's not just about like equity and all that stuff. It's about teaching, you know, men what they need to know on how to be better towards women and the feminine and to respect the matriarchy, because Native men know what I'm talking about when I talk about that, but most white men do not. The term rematriation means a lot of things. And for me, the biggest thing is about taking back the feminine.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate knowing what those words mean to you, because one of the kind of ideas, again, that's at the root of this communication perspective is you kind of, you know, use it as a perspective. And then there's a number of different practices that would be involved in taking a communication perspective. And then also you're oriented toward this goal, which is creating better social worlds. The idea being that through our communication, we have the opportunity to create better social worlds, again, based on what kind of stories we choose to tell and the ways that we choose to show up to each other. And so I can hear through everything you've said today, I'm getting an idea of what kind of your definition of a better social world would be. And it sounds pretty good to me. And again, it is this wildly complex, you know, intersection of all of these things and how it matters to have this understanding of all these things as being interrelated and kind of this, when one person can raise up, we can all rise up. Kind of idea. I guess I know that you talk about, you know, this building bridges kind of idea rather than taking our own selves down through all kinds of fighting and polarization and hate. And instead, you know, moving toward this goal of this kind of better social world that you kind of laid out for us today through telling better stories and taking action as a society.
In terms of taking action, around the term rematriation, we do have a newer initiative, our land back / rematriation initiative. I've always felt like we need to build and create power within our communities, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than just fight a pipeline. Mm-hmm. Because like, what are you fighting for if you're just fighting a pipeline? What are you fighting for, right? And so myself and Shelley Buffalo, we've been working on building a rematriation initiative. And I'm really excited because some Catholic workers in the Wisconsin, Iowa area have put together Honor Native Land Fund. And you can go to their website, honornativelandfund.org. And all the funds that they raise through that will go towards us so that we can buy land. They call it a land tax.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're, you know, together, Shelley and I have talked to hundreds of people about land back, and it's just never come to anything because, like I said, land is power, and it's really hard for folks to part with it, even though they've had, you know, generations of wealth come through it, right? We're working on things like a buffalo harvest that we just had. We harvested 3 buffalo and are giving them the meat out for free in Sioux City and Omaha to the Native communities. And, you know, we'll be working on classes for folks on seed saving and gardening and farming and first foods. And recently, we were just talking about getting involved with the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation and putting together a class for a woman in particular on prairie burns, on how you can, I guess, set fire to the prairie.
Right.
But, you know, in a controlled way, controlled burn, right? And that was a big part of what we did before colonizers came in. And that's a practice that's been lost as well to us. So, you know, we're trying to do all these things. And then also, like I said, get land for folks, because 98% of agricultural land in this country is owned by white people. Brown and Black folks need access to land, basically. And that's what we're working on.
Yeah. Well, Sakawis, thank you so much for your time first and the information you've shared and the perspective you've shared. I really appreciated getting to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, that is all for our conversation with Sakawis. At the end of each episode, I like to offer some questions to reflect on, which act as next turns, things that you can keep thinking about so the conversation doesn't end just because the episode does. Today, the questions I would have you think about are, how can we decolonize our ways of thinking and being? What does it look like to re-indigenize? And what does it mean to rematriate? So really just focusing on some of that vocab that we learned today, some of that language that's really important for the work that Sakawis does and for continuing to change our perspective on and our relationship around sustainable practices, as well as more broadly, perhaps our relationship to nature, to the earth, and to the land. You're always welcome to reach out to me to share your reflections, as well as any of your own questions or ideas. You can do that through email, the website, or by commenting on Instagram and YouTube. I invite you to do this to stay in dialogue. A few other great ways to stay in dialogue are to follow the show wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. You can also leave a rating and review, which I'd really appreciate. But most importantly to me, sharing episodes, inviting other people into this community and into dialogue with us. I am supported by the CMM Institute for Personal and Social Evolution. This podcast is just one of many initiatives designed to create space for more conversations that move us toward those better social worlds that I spoke about today. Other initiatives include the Cosmo Activities educational series that includes our most recent edition, the Cosmo Teens comic book. It talks about mental health and shares the stories of 5 young adults that we were able to work with. The Cosmo Activities line also includes social emotional resources for younger children. And we're currently working on developing resources for parents, which if you'd like to participate in, you can visit www.cosmoactivities.com, find the Cosmo Parents page, and take the survey that we have there. You can learn more about the CMM Institute and all of the initiatives in the link that I provide in the show notes below. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being curious, and thank you for being a part of this story. I'm Abby, and this is Stories Lived, Stories Told.